Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the LSE for today's hybrid event on what is driving the green backlash in European urban politics. This is part of the LSE Festival, and today is actually the last day of a week of events here at the LSE Festival, looking at how power and politics is shaping our world. My name is Katharina Hiecht. I'm the program lead for the European Cities program at LSE Cities and a policy fellow here at the LSE. And before I introduce our speakers, I just wanted to provide a little bit of context about what the inspiration was behind this event. So over the past 3 years, the European Cities Programme has been collecting data on 160 of Europe's largest cities as part of a knowledge hub where we are sort of collating indicators, tracking especially things around city leadership and how that's changing over time. And we've become really interested in understanding how the leadership of cities might be shaped by things such as rising political polarization, around the green transition, and you can see some of that research visualized upstairs as part of the LSE Festival exhibit Displays of Power. So if you haven't checked that out yet and you are here in person today, do have a look at that afterwards. Great. I'm really pleased to be chairing this event and delighted to be able to introduce you to our fantastic speakers now. I'll present them in the order in which they'll be speaking, starting with Kieran. Kieran Cuff served from 2019 to 2024 as a member of the European Parliament, representing Dublin in Ireland. He sat on the Transport and Energy Committees of the Parliament and was the Parliament's chief negotiator for the revision of the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive that legislated for the decarbonisation of the EU's building stock. Prior to his election to the European Parliament in 2019, he served as a Dublin City Councillor, member of the Irish Parliament, and Minister of State with responsibility for sustainable transport and climate change. Then we have Shirley Rodriguez, who was the London Deputy Mayor for Environment and Energy between 2016 and 2024. As part of that, she implemented programs to tackle the climate emergency, reduce air pollution, and restore nature, including being centrally involved in the rollout of the ultra-low emission zone. Before this, she oversaw a global climate change grants portfolio at the Children's Investment Fund Foundation and held various executive roles in local, regional, and national government here in the UK. She's currently commissioner on the Our Common Air Commission, chair of the Breathe Cities Advisory Committee, expert advisor of the Earthshot Prize, and on the board of C40 Cities. Jean-Louis Misica was deputy mayor of Paris from 2014 to 2020 in charge of urban planning, architecture, Grand Paris projects, economic development, and attractiveness. Before that, from 2008 to 2014, he served as deputy mayor of Paris in charge of innovation, research, and higher education. He's the author of Le Business de la Haine on social media and democracy, Le Nouvel Urbanisme Parisien about the ecological transition in Paris, and co-author of Des Robots dans la Ville about autonomous vehicles. And he's also currently a visiting senior fellow at LSE Cities. Last but not least, we have Dr. Liam Beiser-McGrath, who's an assistant professor in international social public policy in the Department of Social Policy at the LSE. He's also the organizer of EPG Online, an online seminar series that explores environmental politics and governance. And Liam's research primarily focuses on the political feasibility of efforts to tackle climate change and environmental problems in looking at the link between economic inequality and public acceptability of ambitious climate action. Welcome to all of you. Thanks for being here with us today. Great. So without further ado, I will hand over, starting off with Kieran. Kieran, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And I'm delighted to be with you here today. I put myself forward for election, and it's just a week since people voted across Europe, and I didn't make it through, so I'm still kind of reeling from the shock of that, but I thought it is useful to put a few initial thoughts together. The headlines today back home in Ireland are Independence Day. So a lot of independent candidates were elected, certainly across Ireland, and indeed to the European Parliament representing Ireland. And it will be interesting to see how they can collectively work in common on issues that they hold in common. I'm not sure if they do. I think they were concerned about that. They were elected because of party systems were falling down, and people wanted to vote for the person close to them. I think, you know, in 2024, over the last 5 years, from an Irish perspective and a UK perspective, people had to deal with Brexit. They had to deal with COVID. They were watching war in Ukraine and a huge amount of migrants coming from Ukraine to seek refuge in Ireland. And they are now watching the atrocities in the Middle East. Do people want to kind of switch off from that? And are they just don't want to look at political parties? They vote for the independents. Maybe there's a little bit of that. But I think if I were to break it down, the backlash against the Greens, I would look at perhaps four areas where the Greens are trying to make an impact. In energy, of moving away from fossil fuels. And the price of energy rose over the last 5 years. But it rose because of war in Ukraine and the fact that at a European Union level, we said we no longer wanted to use Russian gas, Russian oil. And that led to more expensive fuel from elsewhere. And I think voters conflated the increase in the price of fuel with, oh, you're going green and it's costing us more. In the area of construction and buildings, there were price rises due to supply chain issues over COVID, but also the cost of building green is a little bit more expensive. Yes, the bills will be lower once it's built, but it is more expensive, and there is a concern there. I think in agriculture, farmers are not perhaps making as much money as they would have years ago. Personally, I think that's due to below-cost selling in supermarkets. It's due to multinationals, multinational companies paying less to farmers. But it was very easy to kick the Greens on this and say that's the impact of the Greens. So I think that narrative got traction. And then in transportation, I think particularly drivers felt that the Greens were taking away their freedom, restricting their choices. And even though the changes we're making at a city level in Dublin and elsewhere will benefit public transport users by reallocating space in our cities, the perception is you're hitting the motorist and the motorists are the majority. The facts and the benefits tend not to be talked about. So I think looking at the voters, I think the voters are change averse. They want to bring back the good old days. I think they're cost conscious. They're looking at their bills. They're worried. They're worried about housing. They're worried about migration. They're class divided. I think the Green vote has often been a middle class vote. And those who aren't middle class are saying the Greens are taking stuff away. And I think the voters are being lied to. They're being lied to because of lobbying and because of disinformation that has gathered hold on social media. So then, you know, what should we do differently? I think better public engagement, better comms. I think what has been effective has been when we engage with people who are impacted or who are affected, so better stakeholder engagement. I think looking ahead, we need to focus more on a just transition, but I think there will be a slowdown in climate action. And I think the implications from all of this is we need to talk about messaging a lot more. We need clearer messages. I think personally, I think we need to talk about clean air, clean water. We need to talk about safety on our streets from road traffic and other issues. And we need to talk about healthy cities, because I think that resonates. And perhaps in conclusion, using stories more. The stories of what worked for people, I think, can really work. Thank you.
Thanks, Kieran. I think that's a very good segue, actually, to Shirley, who obviously knows quite a thing about, you know, changing messaging and climate action, especially towards health. Shirley, over to you.
Yeah, I was, and again, thank you for having me here. I think a lot of what you said really resonates with the experience that we've been facing in London. So in implementing the ultra-low emission zone, we really started out with, this isn't an environment policy, this is a health and social justice issue, and really kept pressing that. 4,000 Londoners dying prematurely every year, 500,000 Londoners you know, getting asthma or asthma-related illnesses, air pollution-related illnesses, the cost to the NHS and social care systems in the billions by 2050 if we didn't take action. And the policy that we implemented was brought in phases from 2016. So around 2017, we had a toxicity charge in the very central London area to get people used to the idea this was coming in. 2019 was when we first introduced it. 2021 was when we expanded it 18 times to the inner London area, sort of about 5 million people covering. And that was the one that I was really worried about, because this was going to be a massive change. But it went in, you know, so all of those phases, you know, were difficult. We did a lot of communications, raising awareness and so on, but went in fairly smoothly. But it was about then that it massively changed. And the discussion around and the consultation that we brought in about expanding it to outer London to cover a further 4 million people, so covering the whole of London, that whole tenor of the conversation changed massively. Lots of reasons, I think, cost of living, rise of the internet, misinformation, disinformation, just general feeling that people's incomes were being hammered, the issue of choice, you're taking away my choice, there isn't an alternative. All of those things were sort of floating around. But what people really forgot, I think, in those opposing, was actually we did a lot of analysis to understand most people in London, about half the households in London, don't even own a car. They are reliant on public transportation. So we needed to take that into account. And then of those who did have a vehicle, a lot of them had vehicles. We set the standards very specifically to make sure that they were able to comply. So it was actually not, I mean, it was many thousands of vehicles and drivers being affected, but not as many as people thought. And so this is the usual thing about some of these policies, that they come in, people are sort of generally supportive. As it comes closer to implementation, there's a tail off of support. When they come in, then it ticks up and people are very supportive because they realise they're not effective, or they realise they can see the benefits. Our problem was, despite that moral obligation to act and the health benefits that we were really pushing, people, the misinformation, disinformation, but there was also an increase in the lack of trust of politicians, which is sort of to be expected, but also sort of academics. You know, we were using Imperial College to do independent research. We were using doctors and others to take the messages out there. But there were many people saying, I don't believe you, or I don't want to believe you. And I think that is a huge issue for us as we go forward in implementing climate and environmental action as well. How did we deal with that? You know, it was difficult on a personal level. I didn't get as much abuse as Sadiq did. I certainly didn't get as much abuse as some of the campaigners did. You know, they were faced with threats, intimidation, violence. Some of the staff at Transport for London, people putting up the poles with the cameras on. We've had Blade Runners. We knew there'd be opposition, you know, the judicial review, the sort of normal opposition you get in a media, but not that very visceral opposition, which I think, again, has taken a different tenure, and it almost feels like it's baked in. There's a sort of level of opposition from people who are very libertarian or who, you know, talk about choice and say, this is my right to do what I want. And despite Sadiq being re-elected in a historic third term just a few weeks ago, with an increased majority, a massive mandate, it was made an election referendum issue by Susan Hall, the other candidate, and people have come back saying, I want to do this. I want you to do this. And so, you know, despite that, there is still that very vocal minority. And I think just to say, you know, how we navigated that very much, as you were saying, you know, first of all, strong political leadership, unwavering political leadership, despite his own party being a little bit wobbly on this. Making sure the scheme was really designed well to look at fairness, inequality, mitigations. Using that scrappage scheme was a huge support for us to be able to say there is help there for those who need it. It didn't help everybody, but it helped the majority of people. Using trusted stakeholders, mums for lungs, academics, despite some opposition to them, doctors who could really get that message out about the personal experience and the importance of narrative stories, really getting people to understand this is a personal thing to people. And then timing. We set it, you know, and unlike New York, who just pulled their congestion charging, we made sure that we did it as far away as we could do from the election, so that there was time for people to get used to it, to bed and realise actually it's not been implemented. So I'm sure we'll cover some of this in the later conversation, but I'll leave it there. Thank you. Right.
Thank you so much, Shirley. And we'll hear now from Jean-Louis, who will share a bit more on how these conversations are resonating with voters in the French context.
Well, thank you first for inviting me, and I want to share with you a French experience, which is almost a tale. In the summer of 2021, France Parliament passed the Climate and Resilience Law. This law includes three key articles that anticipate significant changes, which have been eagerly awaited by climate advocates. The expansion of low emission zones, the phased prohibition of renting thermal sieves, and the zero net artificialization objective, which seeks to offset land artificialization. Each of these new rules represents a major ecological revolution in its own right. However, each one also poses a political and social challenge, and each is linked to urban policy. Interestingly, during the parliamentary discussions, the media and environmental groups did not hold back in their criticism of this legislation, labeling it as the blah blah law, a text of thousand renunciations, and a mountain giving birth to a mouse. But, and this is the funny part of the story, you know. 3 years on, the winds have changed. On each of these three issues, a multitude of stakeholders are rallying to change the narrative. The public sentiment of not enough or almost nothing has been replaced by the too much, too fast, too strong outcry from an increasing number of observers. The refrain of punitive ecology is once again being heard. The law stipulates that by 2025, low emission zone will be established in all cities with a population of over 150,000. These zones may impose travel restrictions on owners of older vehicles who often live outside city centers but commute into them daily for work. The same media outlets that previously dismissed the law as worthless are now describing it as a ticking time bomb. Mm. The phased ban on renting thermal sieves is causing a surge in demand for thermal insulation professionals and driving up renovation costs. Landlords faced with this reality are choosing to sell their properties. Professional real estate federations are expressing concern about the impact of these measures on the rental market, and co-ownerships are calculating the huge cost of insulation. What was once seen as a half measure because owner-occupiers were not affected is now starting to resemble to a mountain. And the zero net artificialization goal is also causing a stir. Real estate developers, construction professionals, infrastructure providers, and many buyers are starting to question where they can build to continue meeting the demand for individual homes. The common thread running through these three policies is a progressive implementation timeline that was initially perceived as distant and somewhat abstract. However, as time goes on, deadlines loom, and the effect of market anticipation becomes apparent. It starts to feel like a countdown to an economic disaster and a political dead end. So what can we learn from this story? Firstly, major media outlets and opinion leaders often don't read laws thoroughly and rush to make ill-considered judgments. Their criticism and devaluation of the climate and resilience law likely contributed to the neglect of these three policies preparation. Too preoccupied with demanding radical new measures, the Green Party and climate activists pay little attention to those already passed but yet to be implemented. Secondly, stakeholders, particularly professionals, often don't take political promises seriously enough to believe that a medium or long-term commitment could actually have consequences. Some even adopt a strategy of deliberate negligence, refusing to prepare, and then decrying an insurmountable hurdle to secure a government delay. Recently, a major urban mobility player confided that the January 2025 implementation date for low-emission zone in cities was too close to the next municipal election in 2026 to be maintained. There always seemed to be a good reason to postpone a climate change measure. The third and perhaps most important lesson is that simply including a future prohibition in a law doesn't guarantee its application. Clear standards are crucial, but if we want them to have a real transformative effect, it's also vital to prepare for their implementation in the period before they come into force. The political process doesn't end with the adoption of the law. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it's just the beginning. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. I mean, definitely a lot of themes re-emerging here around, from the cost of living to trust in politicians to the importance of timing and follow-through, I guess, all the way to implementation. I'm going to hand over to Liam now, who will talk a little bit about what has resonated here and how that relates to some of the research he's been doing at the LSE around the public acceptability of climate policies.
Excellent. Liam. Right. So I think our current speakers so far have really painted a lot of vivid pictures about what's going on the ground and what's going on in many cities. And so I want to take a bit of time to kind of have a bit of a bird's eye look at all this and to reflect a little bit of how much this green backlash is like really here versus something we're maybe worried about in the future. But also how things kind of changed since maybe 5 years ago, right? So I would say there's been a lot of talk about this is the year of elections. There's so many elections going on all at the same time. We have another election that we didn't expect also going on very soon. And I think it's been useful to reflect on like where climate policy and where green parties are compared to 5 years ago, that kind of heyday of this real rise up in interest and attention in many countries, right? Soon after that, COVID hits, and already then that was the kind of first dent in terms of green action. So my own research within the UK showed that COVID led to a deprioritization of climate change, led to more focus on the economy versus the environment. And we've seen this trend continue as more and more of these big crises happen, right? So first we had the explosion in kind of consumer demand once everything opened up again, which led to kind of issues of supply chains and inflation. And then the fire that was poured on that when Russia invaded Ukraine and what happened with energy prices. And all of these things not only just kind of had these impacts in terms of major issues of like costs of energy, but I think more broadly, people are just thinking a lot more about money and thinking about their pocketbooks in a way that they weren't 6 or 7 years ago, right? There's been issues of kind of stagnant wages and things like this, but at least inflation was relatively stable. Inflation ramping up to double digits in many countries, I think, has spooked a lot of people and made people realize how fragile their kind of consumption behavior and their living styles have been. And this has started to spill over into these areas as we kind of talk about. And so the issue is that this has kind of happened, and in parallel, as Jean-Louis mentioned, the kind of reality of climate policy is starting to hit. We've moved away from the kind of big targets, 2030, 2035, we do this by then kind of world, to concrete actual policy on the ground, which has costs implications, right? And so these two things kind of hitting together at the same time is really a bit of the challenge that's coming at this time and the thing that we need to grapple with moving forward kind of from a kind of political but also a policy perspective. Right, so in terms of the green backlash itself, I would say we should be a bit cautious of like overinterpreting it, but also not be kind of flippant and saying, well, it doesn't really exist. And you kind of see this, I would say, on both sides at the moment. There are some that are basically saying that this is the death of green politics with like what's happened in Uxbridge and the EU elections. You have some who are saying, well, actually, no, there's not really much to worry about. There's some kind of broader trends and you just keep the course and we kind of message in a more effective way and then we'll get there. I think we should take it seriously, but not to the extent that it's okay, people just really don't care about green policy, right? What it brings to the fore is, again, that in general, people are concerned about climate change. They are willing and they do want the government to do something, but they're more and more attuned in terms of what exactly this looks like rather than writing a blank check for these things, right? And so effectively, both from my own research, but also kind of seeing broader research in this area, which has exploded over the past couple of years, it's really more and more kind of key to make clear to individuals what do they get out of this. And so there's kind of some different examples of how this kind of looks like. So the most kind of salient example in terms of people's everyday mobility is obviously things like ULEVs, right? Shirley has talked about this, became quite contested. In the UK, there was a lot of discourse about this with regards to the Uxbridge by-election and whether this swung the difference in this kind of thing. But we can also look at other cases. So for example, in Milan, they had a very similar kind of expansion of this initiative. And Italo Colantoni and some other authors actually looked very explicitly on what happened. And what did they find? Yes, this caused a green backlash. So Lega votes went up for those who were affected in terms of having to pay more to use their cars and vehicles. But if they were able to access compensation from Milan City, then this backlash disappeared, right? So as long as you can very clearly design these green policies with these kind of things in mind in terms of how do we help those who are affected, how do we help them transition, then this is kind of the way forward to kind of stop a lot of the backlash. But again, as Shirley noted, right, there's this communication challenge. And Kieran noted this as well. We're increasingly having the issue that even if you design the right policy, is it cutting through to the electorate in terms of whether they understand, actually, this is what I will get out of it versus what the kind of media or other aspects are kind of talking about. Right, so in my own research, I've looked at carbon taxes, and again, this has been, even before kind of all these crises have hit, it's been consistently shown that the effective way to increase support is revenue recycling, right? So providing either transfers or kind of investments, subsidies that people can directly benefit from, simply kind of reframing things in terms of co-benefits, like this will increase air pollution without being very specific on this, isn't really making the action. But even if you design the policies in this way, if they're not communicated effectively to the public, they make no difference. So, for example, Matto Mildenberger and some other authors looking at, say, Canada and Switzerland, where they have these carbon pricing in place, where they have these transfer schemes, what they found is that actually, particularly in the Swiss case, there wasn't really much of a movement in support from having these tax rebates. And why is this the case? Well, basically, people were getting the tax rebate as a little line item in their health insurance. So not very visible, not really politicized, not really talked about, something you can easily miss. I lived in Switzerland for 5 years and I didn't really notice this as well, right? And if you're not kind of thinking about the design of policy and the communication in the same process and being fundamental to the policy itself, then this is where these issues of backlash emerge. I think the final thing to note here is that, of course, I can say like communication, design, all these things. Right? I think there's a greater challenge, and this is one which has less kind of ease to deal with, and Kieran kind of mentioned it, and I think Shirley as well, and in general we're kind of aware of this, is declining trust in political institutions and declining trust in kind of traditional kind of knowledge-producing institutions such as the media and academia, right? And this is a real challenge because ultimately this trust is necessary for people to think, okay, I'm willing to give up a bit now to get something in the future, right? If I don't trust that that future is actually going to be realized in terms of cleaner air, in terms of a better economy, in terms of better jobs, I'm going to be thinking a lot more in the short term in terms of, yeah, but what does this cost me now? What do I lose now? And I think increasingly this is being seen in many countries, that the long-term challenges are kind of being put off. And there's an increasing focus on, well, we cut taxes now, we give you something now. And if that isn't able to be overcome, then obviously an issue such as the green transition and climate policy is running into real issues. And so maybe we need to think also about how this is not just a symptom of kind of a distaste or a lack of interest in green politics, but more broadly, it's a symptom of the institutions that we're working with as a whole and more our society's ability to deal with these long-term issues, of which climate change is one of the most important. So that's it from me.
Thanks, Liam. Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Great. So we'll open up for a little bit of a debate amongst the panel. I guess I just wanted to very quickly pick up on, Liam, this final point that you made reminded me of something that, Jean-Louis, you have obviously been thinking a lot about recently, and we've just published a think piece by you on in the European Politics and Policy blog on the sort of decline or erosion in trust in the sort of grand political narratives that have defined Western democracy in Europe for the past century, the sort of social democratic and conservative ideals, and a sort of vacuum that has been created where, I guess, a grand new ecological narrative has yet to emerge, which this conversation remains sort of dominated by, I think, a sort of scientific narrative that the IPCC has put forward about what climate change is about, and maybe a failure to translate some of that to a more unifying political narrative. And that creates an issue where people feel like some of this change that we're experiencing doesn't really represent them. You have increasing political polarization. I wonder whether you feel like there is room in the more sort of on the more radical, there's some radical debates that are emerging critiquing the economic status quo. I mean, all of you have talked about the fact that the cost of living crisis has fundamentally undermined people's appetite for more ambitious climate action. I think what underlies that is like we really need to ask ourselves whether the economic model that we are operating under is in itself potentially preventing us from taking climate action in the way in which we need to, at the speed at which we need to, whether you see any space at all for just critiquing this economic status quo and addressing social justice as really fundamental to a green transition.
Yes, it's a good summary of my essay, and I agree that the political narrative of social democracy and conservative is declining, and it is declining because of the success of the ideas of the ecology and environmental issues, because you see that the two traditional political narratives are founded on the idea of the exploitation of the planet, and there is limits, and people see the limits. So this is why there is a weakness in these narratives. But on the other side, the political narrative of ecology is yet to emerge. And I think that the reason is that a political narrative needs to describe a bright future. And all the future described by the political narrative of ecology is the catastrophe. The great, how do you say, le grand effondrement, collapse.
The great collapse.
Yes. The great collapse. So you cannot mobilize people on such a vision. So the main problem, I think, when you are looking to the great narrative, of course, but the main problem, I think, is that how do you build a vision of the future, of an ecological future, which is not decline, restrictions and coercitions. And I think that this is the main political challenge for the people interested in ecology. And I think that I would be a little bit criticism with the Green parties, because the Green parties cannot understand that. Mm-hmm. And this is the main problem why they are not able to mobilize the electors. Have you seen the results of the Green parties in the European elections? It's a disaster. Mm-hmm. In France, they almost have the necessary level to have deputies. Mm-hmm. In Germany, where they are very strong, it's not a good result. And everywhere else, it's difficult. So I think that all the people who are interested, and I am part of them, who are interested with the political battle of ecology, have to have a second thought of how to communicate, politically communicate on ecology to the people. Because now the message is terrible.
I feel like maybe you might want to respond.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I remember when I first ran for election 33 years ago, my colleagues in the Green Party had a picture of a skeleton at a bus stop waiting for a bus. And they said, this will really get people to invest in public transport. And I found a picture of a modern tram from Nantes or Grenoble, and I put that on my literature. I said trams, not jams. And that worked because I was putting forward a positive image of what the future can be. But I think in that broad painting the picture of what the future is, this big collapse doesn't work for anybody. And I think one of the most divisive issues we could have, even in this room, would be growth. Do we need more growth or do we need degrowth? And deep greens would say we need degrowth in everything. Mm. That doesn't work for 85% of the population.
Yes, of course.
But, you know, the European People's Party, the right, far right, would say growth is everything. We can't have, we can't pay for the health service, for education, for everything without lots of growth. And somewhere in the middle is a discussion around sufficiency. And if we can start this conversation about sufficiency, and even that can be divisive. What do you mean sufficiency? I want a bigger car. But if we can start that conversation, and I often, the line I use is that we are in the middle of a gentle revolution. It's changing everything. It's changing transport, energy, construction, agriculture. And if we do it right, it will give you healthy food and a good living for farmers. If we do it right, it'll mean your kids can cycle to school. If we do it right, it'll mean lower bills. It'll mean more choices in your world. But that nugget of sufficiency, I think, is something we have to communicate. Not climate breakdown, but actually it's, you know, this vision of a better world that doesn't threaten you too much. And I think that's what we need to push forward.
Shirley, I don't know if you want to come in, but otherwise I...
That the idea of sort of growth, degrowth, and I think when Sadiq, the mayor, was first elected, and his first special development plan for London, the London Plan, talked about good growth, and you know leading on the environment strategy, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, the circular economy and donut economics and so on. But I think in the end it is understanding that, you know, we are talking about people's lives here who want to have a better life and want to have enough to do that. Not everybody wants a massive car, but enough, you know, do. So how do you balance that? And you do need the, you know, the sort of growth to be able to fund some of the things that we want. So that is very live, but recognise there are limits. And, you know, so our job really was to, how do you build into those, the work that we were doing, whether it's on planning or housing or transportation, how do you get the understanding of what those environmental limits were, what the trajectories were, what could we be pushing people to do as fast as possible, but recognising that there will be losers in this space. So to pick up Liam's points about what are their worries, what are their concerns, how can you show them that you've heard them, understood them, and what can you do to help them? We can't make it all go away. There will be some losers, but you know, those should be the people who can bear it the most easily, and those who cannot, we should be providing information. I think the only other point I'd want to raise is just the sort of narrative and the communications point, absolutely critical, because it's about trust, and I don't know how we counter that lack of trust now, where, you know, it's very actively, and I think this goes back to the you know, the disinformation now. You know, there are very well-funded organisations out there and campaigns who are promoting disinformation against academics, against, you know, politicians, against the policies in the media, who then pick it up and spread it. And that is a huge problem that we faced. And certainly Transport for London did some, their social media team did some monitoring just after the ultra low emission zone went in around September, October, and they saw a 97% reduction in conversations on social media about ULEZ. So once it's in, people moved away, but that doesn't mean to say it's not gone away, because, you know, people are pivoting to things like pay per mile or what we're going to be trying to do on buildings, you know, which is hugely difficult. And I think a slight disagreement about this is a gentle revolution. It's a massive revolution. And we've actually had sort of quite an easy time in doing the sort of easy bits, cycling, walking, you know, whatever. The really hard bits are to come, and they're about people's choices, about their buildings, about their homes, about what they eat. Nobody likes being told what to do. And that is that is going to be really difficult, about sending that positive message about how does it benefit you, your family, the future. It is a difficult one, and we are learning. I haven't got the right answer to this. We're all struggling with this.
I'm aware of time because we only have an hour and I want to make sure we leave enough for questions from the floor. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm going to open up to Q&A now from the audience. The way that we'll do it is probably just to group two or three questions. We'll start with questions from the room and then afterwards we'll go to questions from the online audience. Great. Can we have a question from this lady in the middle here with glasses? Yes.
Okay, my name is LT, and I work for a local council. I'm a policy planner. It's a question maybe for Liam or Shirley. You mentioned Uxbridge. Did you think the councillor made a mistake with not reaching to the Greens because he only lost by, you know, a very small amount? What are you feeling about that?
Okay, let's take a couple more questions over here.
Hi, thank you. Hi, I'm Jonathan. I started a cash transfers charity in the UK. So my question is about how much will attaching far more progressive and very splashy, very explicit wealth redistribution elements to green policies help? And to basically have far bolder messaging and to Liam's point, far less nuance, right? Because when it's too nuanced, maybe it gets lost. So like for you, Les, could you have made the tariff far, far more progressive for people who are in poverty but need their car, and means test it on car value, for example?
Thank you. My question follows from the previous one. I'd like your comments on libertarian paternalism and to what extent you think messaging, habits, behavioral psychology can be used in political, in elections, in campaigning, and in policy to make people more receptive towards green policies. And secondly, if you could comment on how effective the European Union and the implementers of the Green Deal have been in engaging with stakeholders, especially rural farmers, in carrying out the policies, not just about being it's not just about the narrative, but also about the communication they've had and whether they've actually made the effort of reaching out to them or whether it's just been top down.
Great, thank you. Okay, let's maybe start with the question on Uxbridge. Shirley or Liam, whoever.
You know, I think the Uxbridge decision or outcome was, you know, what got lost was yeah, it was lost, you know, and how the politics, you know, Labour wanted to win. They don't want a coalition. I think what was lost was there was a massive swing towards Labour. They only lost by 500 votes. And, you know, really the narrative should have been about, we only lost by 500 votes. Look at the other two elections that are happening at the time. And because people leaned into, you know, a narrative that was being pushed about this was about you, Les, then that's what we've got in terms of the Tories pivoting away now and to ridiculous stories about seven bins you're going to have and you know, you're not allowed to leave your house, you know, within, you know, for 15 minutes.
But there were 1,500 votes for Green that they could have tapped into.
But this is about, you know, getting across the message. You know, this was the right thing to do. And I think the problem there were, you know, there were lots of issues about the local candidate changing, not being very strong enough about the positives about you, Les. And then maybe that would have been, you know, got the green votes swinging away. Maybe.
I mean, I think, like, there's a lot to kind of overinterpret with you, Les, right? So as an academic, I am not going to make a lot of strong inferences from one case, particularly where it's such a narrow margin, particularly where the swing was so much, and particularly because in a couple of weeks it's probably going to be Labour, and then we're not going to be like, oh, well, what was Euler's talking about here, right? And so I think that was one of these cases where it was very overplayed, and I think it was overplayed also in terms of what it means in terms of green policies, right? And I think the Conservatives probably took the wrong lesson from this in terms of thinking that there's this real deep, like, latent opposition to green policies that's there. It wasn't really there to that degree, right? It was overinterpreting of this case, and I think this is what's kind of led them down this dead end now of really rolling back net zero with very little effect in terms of their kind of popularity and vote share. And this is kind of, I think, the real lesson from Uxbridge.
Well, from a French perspective, I think that Ulez, you don't implement ULEZ without support policy, without compensation policies. Because if you take the city of Paris, for example, ULEZ is lived by the population of the suburbs. Like, it's forbidden to go in the center of the city. And for some of them, it's true. It's not true for everybody, because you have a lot of alternative solution of transportation, of public transportation. But in fact, for the people who are the most far from the center of the city, the car is the only solution. And for these people, it's a terrible decision. So I think that if you don't have a global approach of what kind of compensation, what kind of solution you can give to these people, ULEZ will be filled as an inequality decision.
Wonder whether you want to come in on the verdict on how the EU has been doing in communicating around the implementation
farmers.
Of the Green Deal. Maybe not just to rural farmers, but to widen that question out but in general, I guess.
Yeah, there's always a danger. I know in Brussels we have such amount of Brussels bubble speak and Brussels English, and we talk about the Fit for 55 package, and we expect everybody to nod and say, the Fit for 55. Fit for 55 is about reductions of greenhouse gas emissions by 55% between 1990 and 2030. And to do that, we have
Nobody knows what it is.
Nobody knows. That's true. There's a few people in Brussels.
Yeah.
And it's resulted in about 20 new laws, like CBAM. And you go, CBAM? Oh, the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism. This is about a tax on products coming into the EU that haven't paid a carbon tax, like ammonia and steel and concrete. And people's eyes glaze over. The reach out, the communication. I think the lobbyists are doing a better job than the European Commission or the European Parliament, and they do it regularly. I mean, one of the biggest lobbyists that I encounter in Brussels is the Irish Farmers Association, the IFA. They write me handwritten, beautiful calligraphy, handwritten invitations. Can you come and meet some women farmers who want to talk to you about their concerns? But they are being played. They are being played by COPA Cogiga, which is the European farm lobbying body that is paid for by big seeds, by big chemicals, by very vested interests at a European level. And the Irish Farmers Association, they give us the voting lists that COPA Cogiga has, and they say, oh, this is our voting list, if you could vote the way the Irish farmers want you to vote. Very effective lobbying. And the women I meet from small and medium-sized farms in Ireland don't know how the money they pay to the Irish Farmers Association goes into this huge European lobbying firm to resist any change in farm practices. And that is giving us, the farm practices that we have are giving us pollution in our rivers. They are giving us soil that is deteriorating. And that is why we are pushing a nature restoration law, which is about healthy soil. It's about clean water. But by God, the farm lobby is very strong, and the farm lobby are paying more for their communications than we are or the European Commission is. So I feel quite cynical about the influence of farm lobbying in Europe. And we can't pay enough to communicate against those kind of voices.
I want to turn to our online audience. Oh, and we'll take a round of questions from those of you that are online.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a question from Sophie Lee, who's a Year 12 student based in London, and it's specifically for Jean-Louis. What are your thoughts on the dédiabolisation trend of the right wing in France and across Europe? So that's the broadening of the base of the far right that's they're trying to kind of take out some of the radical discourse associated with the far right. But yeah, you can also expand on that. And how does this interplay with the decline in support for the Greens from youth voters? There are also a few much more big picture questions. In what ways are immigration and green policy related? How would you say the war in Ukraine affects climate issues we're facing right now? And then a final question on the influence of dark money and foreign government interventions on the backlash. So lots to pick up on there.
Well, I think that with the ecological regulation, the far right in Europe have found a new battlefield. And this battlefield is about freedom, but not only freedom. It's also about refusing some necessary changes. For example, in France, Mrs. Le Pen is in favor of nuclear power, but she's hostile to wind and solar power. And the refusal of the wind power is about preserving the French landscape. It it has a lot of echo in the population in France, and you have seen that in Germany, the AfD have been surfing on the refusing of the gas boilers, which is in the new law in Germany, and in the Netherlands. This new party, the BBV, I think, it's about refusing the diminution of azote fertilizer in the for the farmers. So you see that all over Europe, the far right is taking this question of ecology and trying to transform it into a weapon against the Green Parties, but not only the Green Parties, again, all the people and all the associations who want to have a real transformation. And maybe one more thing is that they try to design what they call a non-punitive ecological policy. And they try to make a relationship between the borders and the hostility against the foreign people and the preservation of the territory. So there is a real, very dangerous strategy working in the far right, and I think that we have to be aware about what they are doing now on these questions.
Anybody else want to? I guess that sort of maybe transitions a little bit also to this growing dichotomy between we have to decide between defense and green policies, which is obviously an echo we hear in the EU, but also here in the UK increasingly. Wondering if, I don't know, Liam, if you have any views on that.
I mean, I think particularly in response to Ukraine, right, there's this kind of increasing attention in this. And I mean, I've kind of said this a bit in the talk, but also in my research, I'm very skeptical of like framing, right, in terms of that we do a little bit of message massaging here and there and that will move things along. The one thing I've seen over the few years that actually has meaningfully changed things in that is actually this natural security or national security and tying in this kind of shift to renewables as a way of kind of limiting dependence on, say, Russian imports, right? And I think interestingly, if you kind of look into this energy aspect as well, that this is kind of the area where some of these dynamics are playing out that we've kind of talked about before, both in terms of how people think energy kind of should look, but also how it's financed. This kind of goes back to the question that was asked before about like redistribution being more explicit. What you see in terms of like supporting new energy projects, people really like windfall taxes, and people really like things that make the polluter pay, right? So this is kind of increasingly now being more accepted on the policy agenda, given what's kind of gone on the last couple of years in terms of this new source of financing. And in particular as well, what's interesting is that richer individuals in a lot of contexts are actually quite willing to pay a bit more if they know it's going to help the poorer individuals within society, right? So this kind of purely kind of, how would you call it, self-interested pocketbook dynamic of, well, if I'm a richer person and I consume more energy, then a carbon tax would kind of mean that I pay a lot more money. Generally, people are fine with that as long as they know that it is going to then benefit other members in society. I'll just note the only case where this is not actually the case is high-income Democrats in the US, where they are very much opposed to losing money, even if it's redistributed. So again, but I think this is important to go with, like, interpreting the EU elections as well. Like, context really matters. We've paid a lot of attention to Germany and France, but there's other countries where we've actually seen rises in green votes. And
yeah.
One size fits all is not how we're going to get out of this situation.
Very good. Let's take another final round of questions from the room, maybe. Yeah, gentleman over here, who's at the very front in the maroon.
Hello, Andrew Lepage, former student here back in the 80s, currently run waste disposal and treatment services across a chunk of London. But the question really is about what messages have you found actually work at changing behaviour? And we've just had a bit of a small example there about national security and such like, but are there other messages that actually work that we can deploy?
Hi, my name is Marion. I come from Hackney, from a borough in London, which is very green. And I think what this discussion made me think is of the local. You know, we've got, I live in a low traffic neighborhood area. Hackney is very green. We've got the highest cyclists and stuff like that. However, in my borough, we had right-wing fascist parties come and conflate, you know, the ULEZ, the all the sort of green measures with sort of racist and anti-vaccine. There was a point, you know, anti-Brexit, there was a point where everything sort of coalesced together. It's quite scary. And where I live as well, you know, like about 40 or more percent of us were not born there, you know, foreign. It's quite a diverse community. However, we've had protests against ULEZ there and against LTNs, which were very led, you know, by minorities. And the debate on the local forums are about how, you know, these green measures are affecting more or less the poor. That it is what the hipsters want, you know, they've just come in to Hackney and that is their, you know, they like cycling and all of this. So I guess my question is, what can be done about this? Because it's quite scary when you see, you know, a right-wing bubble in a way, you know, like coalescing at local level, which seems to be happening then at the European level, but at local level, we've got that happening. I mean, in our local forum, they don't discuss LTNs anymore because the moment you do, a lot of people come up who do not generally speak on that forum. And it's quite interesting and quite scary. So, you know, some ideas, please. Thank you.
Okay. Should I take?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, maybe just, I guess, both Andrew's question and Marianne's about messaging. I think don't be there are a minority of people. I think that's the thing to remember. They're a very vocal minority, and you know, I've come off next door, you know, many years ago because it was just you couldn't have a sort of sensible conversation, and it was also all about cats being lost, so very annoying. But it just, I think we talked about disinformation as well. There, you know, there are vested interests who are absolutely against many of the good policies that we're trying to implement. But you know, many of the polling, and Liam's talked about this, that you see there's a strong support for climate action, and actually more than people understand, but they are a silent majority. And it's trying to get that silent majority to speak up or to go out and vote for those progressive policies. So I think don't lose hope. I think there are more people out there who are in support of these green policies because they recognise the benefits to health, to the economy, to our society, to our children and so on. But it's trying to remind yourselves of that. And that's how the issue about stakeholder engagement and using local communities who can go out there and talk to people and remind them that there are positives there. And in terms of Andrew's, you know, how do we change behaviour? You know, I think, again, it's looking at what the triggers are. And at the moment, they change all the time. you know, when people were feeling quite wealthy, then it wasn't so much the cost of living and they could think about being more progressive. Now it's about, this is going to cost me. So you've got to, you have to tell people, actually, it's going to save you money over time. Or it might not save you money, but it's not going to cost you more money. But look at these other benefits that it's going to bring to either you or your family. And often people think about their family or the relationships, you know, that have an issue. Certainly on the ultra low emissions zone, the health thing was really about, you know, Sadiq and I would go into schools and, you know, would ask, you know, who has asthma or who knows somebody has asthma. Most of the kids in school would put their hands up. So getting, you know, in many years ago, you know, you might have got one or two. So recognizing that people experience those issues and then how do you, how can you show that this is actually helping them? And, you know, I know we were talking a little bit about ULEZ before, but, you know, one of the big issues there about the support was how, you know, Sadiq's put in over £200 million to help people transition. You know, ideally, we'd have put a lot more in if government had helped. They'd help lots of other cities around the country, but not London. And that was obviously a very political decision that the government has taken. But, you know, it's getting the message out that support helps. And getting people to keep repeating the message, otherwise, you know, it gets lost. People don't always hear the message the first time.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we are out of time. That went really quickly, an hour's a sort of very short time to dig into the richness of this sort of discussion. But I want to thank our fantastic panel for this great contributions. And obviously thank all of you for being here, both in person and online, and wish you all a wonderful weekend after this.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.